listeners, you are listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. Every week, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And on this episode, we will be discussing the very first Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Why Marry? By Jesse Lynn Williams, which won the Pulitzer in 1918. And so this is part of our ongoing unofficial series of our reading Pulitzer Prize-winning plays. Yeah. And so we decided to go all the way back to the very beginning of the Pulitzer Prize in Drama to read the very first play to ever win this prestigious award.
This doesn't mean that we're going to keep moving forward. We're going to read every one of these plays.
Well, We could.
We could. But why would we do that to ourselves? Like, why?
But Sarah and I just got curious. What was in the air in 1918, the first year that a Pulitzer Prize in Drama was given out? And what were people really valuing in the public discourse at that time? And it turns out this question of whether or not to get married was just as hot a topic back then as it is today.
Yeah. Why marry? But I think originally the title was called And So They Were Married.
Mm.
I think that was the original title. And then it was changed to Why Marry? Which is so interesting. Those are very two different titles.
Yeah. Very different.
Yeah.
The name, the title Why Marry is much more provocative.
Right. It is. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Should we just give some initial information? So, because I'm sure you're all going to rush out and read this play. I have to say, I mean, it was a pretty enjoyable read. It's a comedy in three acts. Mm-hmm. It takes place at a country house on a weekend and follows this family. There is a guy named John and his wife, Lucy, who live in this house, and John's two unmarried sisters, are each kind of on their own trajectory of whether or not to get married to these respective men. Mm-hmm. And the younger sister, Jean, is trying to get this guy to marry her, even though she doesn't love him, because that's what she has been, quote, brought up to do. She's been brought up to be married and nothing else. And then her older sister, Helen, is a new woman, a quote-unquote new woman who has a career studying like disease and bacteria and assisting the scientist. And she loves him and he loves her, but she is totally opposed to marriage. And so the play is really about this guy, John, and his various family members and community members trying to convince these two women, but especially Helen,
yeah,
that they really should get married.
A new woman.
Oh, yeah. Man. And then they go through, like, over the course of the play, these various people who are married kind of talk about the highs and lows of marriage. Mm-hmm. Which is so interesting because this past spring, our department just did a production of Company. And I was thinking it would be a really fun thing to pair this play with Company and look at them together.
Mm. That's interesting. I was thinking this play and Dollhouse.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Yeah.
Oh,
why
man.
Not all three? An why not evening all three? Or a weekend of... Yeah, Doll's House, Why Marry, and Company. That would be a really good – I mean, I don't know if there are any producers out there who are looking for a really good idea from us, but I'm just offering that free. It would be a good idea.
Oh, man. All right. So my first impressions was, wow, I can't believe they're talking about getting married or not, you know, this like – conversation back in 1918, like 100 over 100 years ago, because I feel like today, the conversation about marriage is just more like, they're like more single people, like dating is hard, or, you know, like social media is making it difficult, or like people having, trying to find connections that way, or if you are married or like having children and like getting a house, like that, that idea that, oh, what marries a couple, married couple should do and be doing, and like all these expectations, you know, I just feel like it's like these social expectations have never really changed. It's just, it looks a little differently, but
yeah,
it's pretty much the same thing.
A lot of the questions and the factors are the same. Like,
yeah,
this idea of stability and security and social, you know, the idea that the society respects you more as a couple, and that they condone your and kind of witness your relationship in a formal way. But yeah, some of the conversations felt so modern to me and so contemporary. Like, several of the people who are married talk about how, like, I think the judge talks about this, how he has, in his marriage with his wife, has spent like 20 years kind of doing things that he thought she liked, and she was doing things that she thought he liked. And then they find out that neither one of them actually likes this. They're just doing it because they think the other one wants it. And so kind of not being true to themselves, not being really true to each other, but kind of upholding this idea of what a marriage is supposed to look like. Yeah. That felt very contemporary.
Yeah. So the two sisters, Lucy and Helen. So what's so interesting is like Lucy and I forgot his name, Rex.
The other man. Or Gene and Rex.
Oh, Gene and Rex. Sorry, Gene and Rex. So they, their relationship is like very volatile. Kind of like they have to get married to each other because they were seen in a certain way, and it's a little risque, whatever. But now like they have to because it's expected, and but then emotionally, Gene is accusing Rex of like, you love my sister, you don't really love me, and Rex is like, I love you, I do, you know, it's just like all this like back and forth. And then Helen and is it Theodore or
So Theodore is like their cousin.
No, not cousin.
And then her love interest is Ernest.
God, there's a lot of names, you guys.
I know. It's so many characters.
It's such a classic, like, comedy. We're like, let's just throw so many people in here. So Helen and Ernest were, I think their love is very interesting in that they respect each other. They do see each other as equals in some way. Like, and I respect, but they're like, but we don't want to get married. Like, something like just, well, Ernest later, I think he wants to.
Yeah, it's so interesting because he's the one who's like, I really want to marry you. And Helen, she is so adamant that she does not want to get married. And so he decides not to.
She likes him.
Yeah, she really likes him. And she wants to have her – she wants to keep her own house and him to keep his own house and then them to keep working together because she works as his assistant.
Right.
But she doesn't want to – and she wants to, you know – be they want to be with each other,
right,
but they don't actually get married.
Yeah, that's very interesting,
which is so shocking.
So shocking
to everybody else. And sinful and scandalous and yeah
so it's just very interesting that those views about God, like, just the idea of marriage being such a it's just looked at differently in each of these couple.
Yeah. Well, and what I found it very interesting how the play opened with this scene where Jean is like, she doesn't even really like this guy. Mm-mm. But she does, has set up this situation where she like says something rude to him and then runs away so that he'll chase her. And then she's like pretending she doesn't want him to catch her, but then she lets him catch her, you know?
Right.
And I mean, it does feel a little problematic because she's like, let me go, and he's like, you know, forcing this kiss upon her.
Yeah.
And she's like struggling, and then finally she's like, "Okay, love you." I mean, it's just like really ridiculous.
High school, but then, like,
yeah. But then, and it's so funny too that he pointedly tells us their ages. He says, mm-hmm. "She's 25 and he's a year or two older, but they are both children. In other words, unmarried." And but then later she kind of talks about how she orchestrated this whole situation and kind of tricked him into wanting her by running away from him. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, and that leads into this conversation about, you know, in order to get married, women have to be deceptive and they have to be kind of manipulative. And
hey, so how Helen- all right. So how we survive.
Yeah.
This is making me think that, you know, that saying that like, oh, all comedies end in marriage, right? And then mm-hmm. this is just like took that idea and just ran with it in such a crazy way. Like they'll just mm-hmm. like, let's just freaking hammer marriage to the ground here.
Well, but and then at the end they are married. I mean, and in yeah. this very shocking sudden turn of events, they're kind of tricked. Helen and Ernest are tricked into getting married.
Married, yeah.
And then the play ends. It's like
right,
yeah,
like yes. And so, like, what is the playwright saying about that?
Oh, I'm really curious about how this was received. I mean, he talks in his preface about how there were these generational differences in response, and he got this angry letter from a woman who hadn't even read the play, but she was just right. like responding to the title, I guess. But then younger people saw it and loved it and said they were too young to be shocked. But I don't, it's hard for me to really know what he's trying to do with the ending without knowing what the response was like or how it was played, you know, because yeah. it could be really funny. It could. I can see a world in which the ending is just hilarious and they're kind of like tricked in this very rushed way into suddenly being married. And then what's weird is Helen, who's been like, no, 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 I'm not going to get married. After the judge pronounces them man and wife, and the stage direction is that they look at each other bewildered. And then the family is like congratulating them and cheering and stuff. But she never has another line.
Yeah, right.
Which kind of reminds me of Taming of the Shrew, you know, that long silence there. But it's like
she's
silenced by the pronunciation of marriage. And mm-hmm. so, you know, maybe it's funny, but also maybe it's like, oh, well, that sucks.
Right.
I could see it being one of two things. Yeah.
It could be that whatever the actors decide, like that reaction
that
she gives to the audience might say
right
a lot, or
what she's doing on stage, even though she's not speaking, she's doing would speak volumes.
Yeah
But it's hard to imagine that she would be anything other than what she's been all along, which is like really opposed to the idea of getting married. And so when she's kind of forced into it by just the language, which itself is so interesting, I mean, it's the words themselves that force her into this state of matrimony that she has been resisting all along. It's hard to imagine she would be anything other than outraged and despairing, you know?
Right. I mean, this is why you don't have a judge there. You just don't have a judge.
You're saying don't invite judges to your family affairs. Your family picnics?
Yeah.
Good advice, I think. Yeah.
I guess in terms of the writing, like, what have you noticed? Like, is there anything that you would want to pull, like, you enjoyed? I don't know. There's just so much talking in this.
It was so repetitive. Like, people just said a lot of the same things over and over again.
Yeah. This is, this is, like, it says here, I don't know if you guys read the same thing. It was, like, 240 pages.
Yeah, my version was different, but because I read it on Scribd.
Oh, okay.
It was long.
Yeah, it's a long one. Read fast because it's repetitive, but it was like...
I think, I mean, I guess one of the things I might want to borrow or at least just try out mm-hmm. was it was really fun how you had these different groups of people on stage mm-hmm. and they were having like little side conversations. Yeah. And then there was a moment where Helen was talking to Ernest and she said, you know, oh, they're gonna kind of conspire to leave us alone. And, you know, Lucy's going to make this excuse that she has to go lie down and the judge is going to say he has to go write a letter and then so-and-so is going to say he has to go do X, Y, and Z. And then they kind of did that thing. Mm-hmm. They all said what she said they were going to say. And she had the kind of this private joke with Ernest. That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me how, just the joy, the delight in like setting up a joke for the audience that a couple of characters are in on and then kind of showing it unfold.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I really would want to borrow too much else from this play as a writer.
I guess there's a couple things for a comedy. So a few months ago, I like spoke with a bunch of students mm-hmm. about one of my plays and they wanted to like ask questions about it. And one of the students asked me, like, you know, I noticed your plays, because I checked it out, other plays on New Play Exchange, they all seem to take place in, like, one location. I was like, what is that, you know? And I was, like, thinking about that, and my answer was, well, I think about comedies, so much of comedies I feel like are, like, about characters and their flaws, and, like, forcing to, like, recognize those flaws, and mm-hmm. I think when you put them all in one location, it feels like a pressure cooker. That's what it felt like with this play, with all these characters and being forced to recognize this this relationship. Oh, there's two sisters and the relationship with the other men and the family, how with their feelings. It's just like – it just felt like it was this like a slow cooker. It's going to get built up and then it's like
– yeah. And they can't get away. There's no escape.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's something about that by the – that's why some of these lines were just so funny. Like they're just like the way they were reacting to each other and the reactions because they can't escape.
That's so smart that you say that, because he says in the preface of the one I read, he says – he's talking about the set and he says outdoor scenes are not supposed to be good for comedy. Walls – or a suggestion of them produce a better psychological effect for the purpose, beside making it possible to speak in quieter, more intimate tones mm-hmm. than when the voice spills out into the wings and up into the paint loft. And I never really thought about how, so many comedies are set in indoors mm-hmm. with these walls kind of pressing in.
Yeah.
And just the effect that has of the psychological pressure on the characters.
I think about I feel like that's why I really love The Office, the TV show Office. Mm. Like, it's all set in one office and they're all forced to – they're all working together in this small mm-hmm. office. And on a single work day, like just mayhem happens because their boss is nutty. Like, you know, like
– yeah, and they can't get away from each other.
They can't get away from each other because they have to work.
Like, yeah.
The walls. That's what – so I guess it's like thinking about location in that sense of like, okay, this is like a country house away from the weekend or whatever, and here that it's happening here equally, like what are the locations that like we can't let the characters escape, you know, like mm-hmm. this, they're forced to recognize and be here and reconcile themselves and each other. So that's one thing I thought about. And the thing I want to talk about too is that because this is the first Pulitzer Prize winning play, I wondered if this like set a precedent of like what kind of plays would win a Pulitzer Prize. And so I was like, okay, so, you know, what was going on at the time? Women's suffrage, the movement, and then there's this, you know, maybe more women are working, you know, like all mm-hmm. this ideas. And so this idea of marriage, like as a centerpiece of the play becoming very like what is a playwright trying to say about marriage, you know, like very like a singular topic, and they're just sort of really looking under the microscope in that sense, that just looking at it carefully.
Well, yeah, and just the idea that a drama – that a Pulitzer Prize-winning drama should look at a social issue mm-hmm. and kind of explore it in a way that yeah. feels a little bit risky.
Yeah. And this was a comedy, so it wasn't like, yeah. oh, I'm going to write a freaking trauma porn and just and like yeah. scare people and make them right. upset. But it was also a comedy. So it's like seemed to be very accessible too, that people were able to, I don't know. So something.
I know, it's very funny, but it makes me wonder, again, for the audience watching this, would they be laughing at these people thinking like, oh my God, I would never speak about marriage in that way, or I would never speak about my wife in that way, or would they be would it be a laugh of recognition, like, oh yeah, that's how we are in my marriage?
I think it's like all of the above, because mm-hmm. I feel like you touched on every character had some point of view about marriage
mm-hmm.
and so yeah. The fact that Helen ends up, even though she's so adamant of not getting married, but she gets and ended up getting married. Sounds more like tragedy.
I know.
But in this, but because of the rule that, oh, all comedies end in marriage, like follows that rule, but is it really tragedy because she's
well, yeah, married? But then think about like what if they hadn't gotten married yeah. and the play ended with her leaving her family, you know, and then creating this whole rift. It's hard to see how that could be a comedy.
Mm.
I mean, that really actually feels like a Doll's House.
Yeah.
You know, like if she left, because there was no way that her family was going to come around and say, you know, in this one weekend.
Yeah.
And say, you're right. You can live with this guy as his mistress and not get married and we'll just support you. Like that was just never going to happen.
Yeah.
So it would have had to end in her leaving her family or leaving the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to see how that could have been accepted as an ending for a comedy.
Interesting.
So in a way, it's like the genre forces this ending. There's no other option within the genre except for it to end with a wedding. And yet that feels so tragic for this character.
Mm. Well,
who do you think is the protagonist?
Oh God, I don't think there was one for me. I mean, I feel like traditionally it maybe feels like Helen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, yeah, I felt like so much more invested in her story than anyone else's. But yeah. As we're talking about this, I'm wondering if for the author. It was John. It was this guy who's like has these two sisters. And the way they're talking about marriage makes him like question his own marriage, but not really. I mean, there's that moment where his wife is like, I'm going to leave you. And then he says, no, you're not. You know, I own you. You can't leave me. And then she's like, okay. But I don't know. I mean, if I'm just wondering if for this male playwright in 1917 when he wrote it, if he was really looking at it from John's point of view, and like the way that these two sisters and the way they talk about marriage is kind of threatening to overturn his worldview, but then at the end they're both safely engaged. Well, actually one is married and one is engaged, and so all is right in his world again.
Yeah.
I mean, if we look at it from his point of view, it's definitely a comedy.
Right, right. Yeah. Oh, I'm trying to think that maybe – I guess I'm trying to think like, okay, in this comedy, like who's like the straight man and mm-hmm. who's not, you know? And I thought that maybe Helen was like the straightest of them all because she's just so
mm-hmm.
so strong on her belief and like I'm not going to do it. Like, I'm not, you can't change me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone feels very, everyone else feels like they're easily swayed. But yeah, John, you might be right that he seems to be like center of the different, all the relationships.
Yeah, and it just feels like if we accept that this is a comedy, mm-hmm. and things turn out okay in the end, like who do they really turn out okay for? John, right. Yeah. You know? Because he...
Right.
Yeah.
Because he's so adamant about like, this is the way it is.
Yeah.
This is the way we should be. Or like, then his sister's like getting married. Like he's so...
And he feels responsible for seeing his sisters married, and right. You know, and at the end of the play, he gets that.
Yeah. And everyone suffers. Well,
what else is new?
What else is new?
It's interesting, though, in the character list, how each character is kind of described in terms of their relationship to marriage. Mm-hmm. So we have Jean, who's been raised to be married and nothing else. Rex, who has not been brought up to be anything but rich, but is unmarried. Mm-hmm. Lucy, who's married and is trying her best to be an old-fashioned wife.
Right.
Uncle Everett, the judge, who belongs to the older generation and yet understands the new and believes in divorce. Theodore, who believes in everything except divorce. John, who owns the house and almost everyone in it and does not believe in divorce. Helen, who doesn't want to marry anyone. Ernest, who believes in neither divorce nor marriage, and a bunch of other people. But that they're all initially framed as like whether they believe, whether they're married or not, and whether they believe in divorce or not. Mm-hmm. And those are kind of the defining characteristics that set them up in these interesting relationships and conflicts with each other. But just the idea that you could... And they say in the play, one in every 11 marriages ends in divorce at this time. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you could still have a question about like whether people believe in divorce or not, that feels very dated.
Yeah, that does feel dated. So, So which of these characters do you view?
Oh, American I'm 100% with Helen.
Let's see. I think I'm a little bit of everybody, depending on my situation. It's kind of interesting. Like, I feel like I'm the oldest of my siblings, and I felt like I was like the caretaker of their life. And then, you have to go to college, get a job. Like, I was like, okay, Helen. And then I feel like I'm Helen 98%, and then the 2% is like Ernest or something. I don't know.
Well, yeah, because you're not like, I didn't want to marry anyone, because obviously you got married.
I did get married and have a baby. Oh, man. It's so funny.
But it really draws into focus how the options back then were just so different. Like, you couldn't have a career. You couldn't – if you were going to get married as a woman, you were expected to quit your job.
Yeah.
So, obviously, that's different now. It's interesting that there's a whole conversation where – I wonder if I can find it – where Helen is talking about how, you know, men used to control us through physical force, and now they control us through financial force. And then she's like, but pretty soon they're not going to be able to do that either.
Oh my God. You know, this reminds me, did you know there's like a dating app where couples are like dating based on their salary? Like,
really?
How much they make. Yeah, there was something that came out recently, like a few years ago. I think it was before the pandemic, but there was this whole app where men and women were finding each other, and then they were only dating based on their salary. Like, wow. They had to be like equal to what they were making, and that's how they were meeting.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
I mean, it's like weird, but it's also – this is – I mean, that's so 19th century. I know there's a dating app called The League that's for people who went to like elite schools.
Really?
Yeah, and you have to be invited. Oh. You can't just sign up for it. Someone has to invite you.
That's so incestuous. Like,
Ugh. Yeah. Oh, yeah, God. League as in Ivy League.
Wow. I mean, you don't need an app for that. I feel like that already happens. Like, right. Oh, you're in Harvard. I went to Yale. Let's freaking make byways.
And that's how it happens.
Yeah, that's how it happens. And they keep making douchey wasps. So, anyways.
No offense, listeners, if that's you.
That's you. Sorry. I'm sure it's not you, because if it's you, you wouldn't be listening to it. So, let's be honest.
I'm listening to Why Mary. Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess last year we talked about, if this was a smell, what would it be? No, but what should this year be? Like, I don't know. I feel like we need a new question.
If it were a meal, or if it were like a dish. Or if it were a dessert.
Oh, a dessert? I like dessert.
Okay, if this were a dessert, what would it be?
I want to say like Snickers ice cream bar.
Oh, interesting. That's so not the direction I was thinking.
Oh, really? Okay, here's why I think so. Because I feel like at first it's like, it is enjoyable, kind of like, but then you eat too much of it, it's like, oh, this is so sweet, and it's getting really sickly. Mm. And like, I'm kind of getting sick of it. Mm-hmm. Sick of it. But it's also Snickers, what we know is as a chocolate bar, like a candy, but made into an ice cream. So I feel like during this time, it was trying to be something different, innovative, or something like those challenging ideas. So something different. So that's why I'm going with Snickers ice cream bar.
Okay, nice. I can see the logic. I was thinking like a lemon bar, but for similar reasons. I was thinking, a lemon. First of all, it's kind of a summery outdoor kind of dessert, which feels like the vibe of this play. Like,
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Ice cream, yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like in the times in my life when I'm like, oh, I want a lemon bar, the first bite is good. Yeah. And you think it's going to be what you want, but then ultimately it's just kind of unsatisfying.
Yeah. And that's why those bars are, they're not big. They're just kind of like little, they're not too big. They're kind of small, so you're going to get sick of it.
Right. And it's kind of a polite dessert. Yeah. But polite. It's like not satisfying.
It's a polite sir dessert.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I tried. I tried. I can tell
you've been practicing your jokes.
I'm trying. It's just really the lack of sleep. That's
so. Would you recommend that anybody read this play? And if so, who?
Don't be crazy. What we've done is crazy. Why did we read the Humberto Pulitzer Prize winning play? I guess if you're curious of what the first one was, and but.
Well, would you recommend it to someone who's trying to decide if they should get married?
Married? Yeah.
I think it makes some good arguments for and against.
I think so. Yeah, go for it. See how much time has changed.
It's better than flipping a coin.
Yeah, it's better than flipping a coin. Read this play and then, contemplate. And if you're contemplating, I don't know, maybe get out of there.
I mean, I will say it did make me feel a lot better about being single. Like, really? Very, it definitely confirmed everything I love about not being married.
Oh my gosh. You know what's so funny? I love being married and stuff. It was just like, now that I have a baby, just like the dynamic is just so different. It's like,
yeah.
But I love my baby. I love my husband. I love my baby. I love my little family we've created. But man, is it, it's a whole new level of like hard work that I never thought I kind of underestimated, I guess. But
how does Butters feel about the new dynamic?
Oh, Butters, my poor cat. Collected. It's so funny. So I feel like just recently they both recognized each other as another being. Yeah. And so Butters has been like more curious and approaching the baby like, aww. Oh, this is kind of dangerous. Like Augie was napping on the couch, and then you know, Butters loves when we're like napping or like sleeping or on the lying on the couch, she loves jumping on her belly and like mm-hmm. lying on her belly. I thought she could, I think she thought she could do the same with the baby. She was like about to jump on Augie lying down. And I was
that
like,
would
I
not be good.
I catched her, like I caught her before she did that.
Oh
and
my
I'm like,
gosh.
No, because I think she recognized, but I'm like, I don't think Butter recognized a baby is not an adult. You know, it's like
right
something. It's very weird. And then
they would both Augie, have been in for an unpleasant surprise.
Oh my god, I don't want to imagine what's gonna what would have happened. But and Augie is like noticing Butters, like he's aww. He's starting to track his eyes and like so he sees that there's another being like moving around the living room. So he's like following it with his eyes, like what is mm-hmm. this small thing that's you know. On the floor, the ground, just walking around, pacing. So, but every time Augie cries, that pitch, high pitch cry, Butters is just like, you could tell she's so sick of this. She just goes into aww. Her little box and just like sleeps and hides.
She needs a vacation.
I need a vacation. Jesus, Sam.
Well, the difference between you and the cat yeah. is that you brought this upon yourself and she had no choice in the matter.
Whatever. I'm doing a lot for her. She's fine. She has a roof over her head. She's fine. Oh,
well, I am very sympathetic to you as well.
All right. Okay, cool. Let's move on to Glisten.
Okay. I'll go first. Okay. I saw such a good show last night. There's a company in Denver called Buntport Theater. Mm-hmm. And it's this group of, I think, five artists that all went to college together. And then they, after college, they started a theater company. And they have made like over 50 brand new plays together. They don't refer to it as devising, but I think a lot of people might think of it as kind of a devising-like process where they start with an idea and they kind of riff and, you know, rehearse and riff on each other and come up with ideas and then turn it into a script and then make the play. And this play is called Best Town. And it's about this town in British Columbia where there was a molybdenum mine for 2 years. And then I don't know exactly why, but the mine closed. And so all the people left. So the town's called Kitsault. And it's like a ghost town that has all these buildings and is just completely empty. Everything is there except the people. And they made this play about the caretakers of this town. So there are three people who live in the town and like clean the library and mow the grass and kind of maintain the town, except nobody lives there. And and then there's a fourth person who lives like outside the city gates and she's not allowed to go in, but she's like monitoring the town, monitoring the mine. But it's about isolation and loneliness. I think they were thinking a lot about the things that they were feeling during the, especially during the early days of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But the way that they use on stage live cameras, and then they had all these, I think there were like five or six screens on stage. And so you can see what the cameras are catching. You can see it on the screen. So that was really, really cool. And it was just so funny. And they had these great characters that they came up with. And, yeah, if anyone is listening to this in the Colorado area, I really recommend this play, Best Town.
Best Town? Check that out. My list of plays that I want to read ends up is growing so much longer, and I don't think I'll ever catch up.
Yeah. One, it made me wonder, because they just do their own plays. I don't know if they even publish them or like if they're ever done anywhere else.
Oh, interesting.
So.
You think it's, wait, so it's. Devised? Did you say?
Yeah, but they don't use the word devised. Oh, they say they kind of like create and develop it and write it together. Mm. But I don't know. I mean, they've developed so many plays over the years because they've been around for like 25 years. But I don't know whether those plays are ever done elsewhere or if they're even available.
Oh, cool.
So don't worry about adding it to your list.
Okay, I'll just scratch it off. All right. That's the thing about like theater where you could only see regionally or like you can only see places. It's like, I wish some sense like there was a way to make it more accessible. And then, I don't want video either. I don't want to see it on streaming.
Right.
It just doesn't feel the same.
No, the live aspect of it was really integral. Yeah. But you know what, Sarah? You're in LA. I think you've got enough to see there. Just let Colorado have Funport Theater.
Okay, fine. Fine. Okay, so my glisten is I got a Los Angeles Public Library card.
What?
I know.
So cool.
I've been meaning to get an actual physical card. I have like the e-card, but I can't have the same access to resources that they have. So one of the cool things I didn't know that you could borrow through the library, the public library, is that you can borrow like a national park pass and then
what?
For, like, 2 weeks or something, and then like for free parking, and you could just go to any of the parks in California. Oh my God,
that's so cool.
Yeah, so you could just kind of borrow it. So I was like, oh, that's so cool. I'm sure there's like a wait list or whatever, but I wanted to get the library card. So, and there's also the main library downtown LA, I think that's where it's located. I'm just double check, but there's this like whole room where it's all about design. Like there's a printer, there's like a podcast studio, there's like 3D printing, there's like this
cool
with a library that you could have access to with the library card. It's the oh my gosh, I'm missing her name. Olivia, she was a sci-fi writer. Olivia something. I feel like you know. Oh, Butler.
Olivia. Oh, Butler? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a room named after her. And I have all this like access to resources and like design and computer. And like, so I was like, oh, I want to check out the library and like see what's there. And I want to 3D print something.
Yeah, that's so cool.
But yeah, so I was like, I need to get a physical library card to do that. And so I went to I just walked down the street with Augie, got a library card. And so hopefully we'll make a lot of library trips in the future.
That's a good thing to do with a baby.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm really excited about my library card. Wow, so domestic.
Is that from Arthur? Were they like having fun? It isn't hard when you've got a library card.
Yep.
Oh, what a good show.
Yeah. Is it fun? Yeah, it's so fun. Okay. All right. Well, listeners, I hope you go out and get this play. Actually, you can just find it online. It is so old that it's on the archive. You can just Google it.
It's available. It. Why Mary? And let us know once you've read this play whether it changed your views on marriage.
Yeah. Or not.
Or not.
That's okay, too.
That's okay, too. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.